Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to Cockpit to Cowl, the show that explores general aviation safety topics from the combined perspective of flight instructors, pilots, and mechanics, exploring both pilot and aircraft topics to make aviation safer and more enjoyable. I'm Jeff Simon, pilot, AMPIA, and president of Social Flight.
And I'm Brian Schiff. I'm an aviation educator. I host the Proficient Pilot YouTube channel, and I've been an active flight instructor for 39 years. On the side, I fly big airplanes for a major U.S. airline.
big. I love the way you put that. Big airplanes for a major U.S. airline. Brian, I want to kick off the show here with one thing. I want to thank Avemco Insurance that has such a strong focus on education, on safety, on really being proactive in our industry. And they have come on board to support Social Flight and to support this program. And as you have a program coming up, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've got a program. It's an aviation education variety show starting this January on the, I think it's the second or third Thursday of every month, called The Schiff Show. And it's going to be an evening full of Schiff for 1 hour. And Avemco has decided to get behind us on that because the goal will be to reduce accidents. And that no one can, you know, benefit from that more than Avemco, but so can you. And they've offered a generous contribution to that to help us do that. And it's in everybody's best interest to make our operation as safe as we can. And I really am appreciative of them for helping make this happen. It should be a great, fun show.
Absolutely. And special thanks to Marcy Veroni and Megan Thomas from Avemco for making all of that possible. Now, the reason we bring this up is because you're going to get to see lots of educational content that'll be available on Social Flight. Just go to socialflight.com or get the free mobile apps for Apple and Android devices with Social Flight, and you will see all of the different educational events that are happening. Many of those are sponsored and brought to you by Avemco, and we'll be working together with them to bring even more content to you, especially during the winter months, which is what we are here to talk about tonight. When you can get out to fly, when you can't get out to fly, all the issues that surround this. Now, Brian, I know you are down in the Dallas-Fort Worth area where you guys have a different definition of winter than we do up near the Boston area.
A little bit. But everybody, you know, that raises a good point, though. Our entire country has a different definition of winter, of summer. The seasons are so different all around our country. I mean, if it gets 50 degrees outside, I mean, I'm bundling up.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the big things, unless you live real close to the equator, one of the big things about winter is you're dealing with a lot of temperature swings. And so even if we're not talking about real, real extremes, I would like to for us to cover some things tonight that have to do with both preparing your aircraft, maintenance of it, what happens when you go out there to the field, and then what matters in the air. And I know I certainly have some questions for you. Where would you like to start?
Well, I think we should start where any good flight starts is with the pre-flight. You know, you're going to go flying tomorrow. You look at the forecast, you see what the weather is, and it's going to be nothing but cold, really, really cold. And so I'm thinking, you know, gloves and hat and things that I'm going to need to protect myself. But, you know, I want to know, a lot of people just won't fly when it's that cold. They don't want to damage their engine. I'm not going to crank that thing because the oil is too thick. All of us who don't have the 100% knowledge of the aircraft systems and the engine like you do, for fear of, you know, damaging it, might just not go flying, but we probably could go flying. So I just want to hear about what you would do with your airplane. You're going to go flying. It's what, minus 20 Fahrenheit? That's like,
okay, it's not minus 20, although I'm sure we have some folks from Alaska or further north like Minnesota.
Well, like, what's the limit? When can you fly? When you can't? When can you start your engine? When can't you? That's what I'd like to look at. And then some things that you'd want to look at on your airplane. What would you look at? What are the gotchas for winter flying and night flying? Because we're going to have more nighttime, you know, that you look at as a mechanic. That's what I would like your perspective.
Well, let's start with talking about what, when you talk about thinking about damage to the aircraft, what the reason is. What are we trying to avoid?
Well, the first thing I think of is starting an engine with really, really cold oil.
Right. I heard you say that. And, you know, it's interesting. That's an interesting, you know, concept there. But the reality is it's a bit of a misconception. First of all, if you're using modern multi-weight oils, which everyone should be using, we'll get to that in a minute. If you're using multi-weight oil, especially something like, you know, Phillips 20W50 or something like that, you're already going to be good when it comes to the flow rate of your oil. And you think about thick, heavy oil, you're going to be good within almost any reasonable range, meaning like, you know, you're down to the whatever you're talking about flying at 20 degrees, 10 degrees, something like that. But that's not good enough, because that's not actually the problem. The problem isn't that we're trying to pump heavy, thick oil, because we already solved that, right,
with
multi-grade oil. The problem is that in order to make an aircraft engine, a light engine, we have all these dissimilar metals. You got a steel barrel with an aluminum piston in it. You have, you know, crank cases. You have the crank, which is steel. You've got the case, which is aluminum. You've got bearings that are copper and Babbitt material. All these different materials, but the biggest one that we always think about is the piston and the steel barrel. Now, of course, the head is also aluminum, so you've got another factor there. What happens is, as soon as you take something that is really super cold and then light a fire and compress it, you heat that thing up like that. And if you were to get all sciencey here and look at the expansion rates of those metals based on the temperature change, the rate of change, you would see they're vastly different.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. And, you know, I can almost relate to that. I remember being taught on the operations side, flying a 757-767, they have bimetallic rudder hinges and activations and everything. And I know that throughout the flight, as the rudder would get cold soaked, we would have to keep retrimming it because of the different rate of expansions of the different metals.
Yeah.
And so that can kind of relate in that respect, but that's something I hadn't thought about, is the different metals in the engine expanding at different rates.
That's the killer. That's the killer. I mean, think about something like, we've had pilots of the SR-71 here on the show, Phil Soucy, some other folks about it. And that's an aircraft that, just based on the temperature change that it flies in, like, quite frankly, pisses out fuel all over the ramp. Once it gets to flying, it expands, tightens up. The whole plane grows by like 10 inches. Well, inside your cylinder, that piston, okay, with those rings on it, everything, quickly, the aluminum just, boom, gets a lot bigger, much quicker than the steel does.
Mm.
And so what happens is you get scraping, you get scuffing, which is when the piston, and it's a little asymmetrical on the power stroke that comes up, and the skirt is going to rub up against the side. It really can wreak havoc inside your cylinder.
Would that be something that would cause the piston pin cap to come displaced a little bit too? I remember, because I had an issue with that a long time ago.
So those have many things that cause those issues. So is it possible? Sure, that is possible. It could affect that. But there's some other factors that Lai Ko-ming has had with piston pins.
So now I'm even more scared to go flying when it's cold out. So
no, the key is preheating. That's the key. Okay.
Okay.
So here's the thing. This is all solvable. It's very simple. You just have to preheat. Now, the engine manufacturers all have recommendations about what they consider, you know, that they want you to reach in terms of preheating. Personally, they might say, like, well, as long as you're above freezing, as long as you're above 30 degrees or 40 degrees, it depends on, you know, look at what your engine manufacturer recommends. But I go beyond that, because quite frankly, when we think about a few more minutes of taking the time, versus what the cost of anything we induce as damaging the
Yeah.
engine. None of it's worth it. So I personally like to see about 50 degrees on an engine before I go
Where
and
do you
see.
see that?
Just boom, fire up whatever it is, your CHT gauge. If you have a CHT gauge, could be a needle, could be a digital
Okay.
monitor. It's going to be like what you see in there. But what's more important than a specific number on that is that it's evenly distributed. Because you've got everything inside that cowl when we're talking about engine that you want warm.
So
And
the incandescent bulb that I put in the sh my shop light in my cowling while it's winter nights is probably not good enough. It's only heating like one side of the airplane.
actually, do you use a blanket?
A blanket? No, I
An
don't.
engine cowl blanket?
No, I don't. But like a moving blanket you put over the top of your engine
Oh,
cowl?
no, you can go and get a really nice fitted monogrammed engine blanket that goes over your cowl and velcros in, and it's a big snuggie for your engine,
Oh,
and it goes around the prop.
and that helps with, now I've seen them, like I've watched that show, Buffalo Air in Alaska and in Canada, and I've seen them blanket their engines. Even in the hangars, that really help.
Oh yeah, I have one on my plane right now in the hangar.
So where is the best place to get those without?
There's a bunch of different sources out there. There's Canon, the aircraft covers. There's Bruce's. There's
Bruce's is where I've gotten my
there's a
stuff.
whole bunch. Until one of them gets on our board, we won't go and sponsor one.
Gotcha. Well,
But
that's a good idea.
they're all good. Honestly, they really are all good. And
Okay.
so it starts with even heating, having enough time to soak everything in,
Yeah.
and not doing this. I don't recommend that you do this long term. This should be something that you can use any method you want. You want to use a light bulb, as long as it'll do it, and I don't think a light bulb's really going to do it these days, especially with LEDs. But I don't,
Right. Yeah,
I don't
no,
think it's going to cut
inside
it.
incandescent.
But if you put a light bulb in there, depends on what your temperature is. You're down in Dallas, it might work fine for you. It's not going to cut it for us here up north.
Right.
But if you put a source in there, if you want to be at the kind of bottom end of the spectrum, and you just give it enough time, which is that's like an overnight. You're going to take
Yeah.
a long time, and you
Yeah.
heat everything up in that compartment with a nice blanket on it. You're probably going to be good. Personally, I recommend things like the TANis system,
Yeah.
which are they have points and heating elements on every part of the engine, and that's super important.
Yeah, that I've had the president of TANis on my flight one time, came up and talked to us, and made a very good case for that. Seems like, I guess it's where you live and how often you'll use it is how important that is. I can also put it in the hangar at an FBO for a while. What about something like that in a heated hangar?
Hey, let me tell you right now, there's nothing better than borrowing a heated hangar for long
And
enough to get out. No, there really isn't.
to
Because
do my
we're only
pre-flight in
talking about
there.
the engine,
Yeah.
right? If
Yeah.
that's all we've talked about so far. So
Yeah, there's the
let's.
cabin, there's this the seats are get really hard when they're that cold. I mean, there's a lot of little things that you don't really
Yeah.
appreciate.
I want to cover a couple quick things before we leave the engine. And
Yeah.
that is because they're kind of common misconceptions that are important. The first is the idea of even heating. And again, I don't care how you do it. You want to put a blanket on it with a light bulb, that's fine. You want to get a complete TANis system like I have, with every part of the engine heating it all up at the same time. Personally, I think that's a great solution with a blanket. Still kind of heats everything in the compartment. So even heating is really important, because if you're only heating something like, let's say, the oil, like the old style oil heater pans or something, you're evaporating moisture out. And what happens when you take a shower? Where does all that moisture go? Where's it condense?
On the cold things.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the cold things are often parts inside the engine
Yeah.
that you haven't heated that become very susceptible to damage. That can be, if you have a Continental engine, that can be your starter adapter. You have Lycoming, that can be your cam and your lifters. It wreaks havoc by saying, I'm only going to heat this, and all the acids and all the moisture is going to go up here and start condensing like dew on all your most vulnerable components. That's a bad, bad idea, unless
Yeah.
you're flying just all the time.
Yeah, on that note, when you have a lot of changing temperatures, it just made me think also good advice that I like to give is keep your fuel tanks topped off. Don't leave a lot of air in
Ooh,
the tank for the very same reason.
that's a big one. And
Yeah.
even more important during the winter when you get these big temperature swings up and down, because that's where your vents act as a pump.
Yeah.
You literally expand air out, breathe air in. They're breathing throughout the day with those temperature changes, and they're
Yeah.
bringing moist air in, and then it condenses, and then they
Yep.
breathe out and moist air in. This cycle just keeps going.
Yeah, my aircraft
Aside
is hangared, and I left it like that in the cold for a little while with half tanks, and there's no other way water could have got in there, but I drained a little bit of water out.
Yeah, that makes sense. The last thing I just want to make sure I also get out there is the folks that like the idea of keeping their engine preheated like all the time. And I know if you have access to like a Wi-Fi switch or a cell switch, that's great. Not everybody wants to do that. And it's a pain to get out there the night before in some cases. But let me tell you this, one of the biggest issues with winter and damage to engines is this kind of like yin and yang. On one end of the spectrum, you have a benefit, and that benefit is that corrosion is highly affected by temperature. And not a lot of people realize that. If you look at the temperature chart and corrosion rates for metal, you would see this exponential curve. And so when you have this cold soaked engine, when you see a plane that is just no one's flying it for a month in the winter and it's sub-zero temperatures, believe it or not, that plane is actually not corroding very much because it's like so cold soaked. That same plane for that same duration in a warm climate, even if it isn't salty or something like that, corrosion rates are off the charts compared to the cold
Right.
temperature. And
And
so
so that's
because
your case against preheating 24/7, 30 days in a row or whatever, if you're not going to be flying.
Yeah, why do you want to
I
do it
got you.
unless you're going to be flying, right?
Yeah, that's a
So
good point.
if you're going to make your engine all toasty, and then you're not going to get out there because you look out there and between you and the plane is a bunch of snow and ice and junk, and you're like, nah, not
Yeah.
today. You're just keeping this environment of corrosion going where it
Right.
could be the opposite.
Now, real quick, what if you're flying, you got a brand new engine and your tolerance is already pretty tight because is that going to be worse to just.
No, people think of like tolerances with engines. When aside from break-in, you're like your initial flights, like you're
Yeah.
talking 5, 10, 15, 20 hours, whatever it takes for that really basic stuff. Aside from that, no, the tolerances aren't quite what people
But I
think.
mean, like during break-in, do you want to start an engine in when it's really cold or something? And because if it.
Winter's a great time to break in an engine. You just warm it up first.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, just like we said, bring it over 50 degrees before you start it.
Right.
That happens to be my personal number. If you want to bring it up to 70, you want to bring it, whatever, it doesn't matter. And then just, it's a great time to break in an engine because you can go full power, get all this stuff to break those rings in, and now you don't have to worry as much about overheating.
That's true. Yeah, I would just be worried about initial start and warm up, and then when can you add power? So that was another thing I was going to ask you. You want to warm it up at idle. Let's say if it starts at 50, can you, if you see it 50 degrees and it's evenly heated, can you go right to go do your run up as soon as you taxi the run up area, or should you wait a little while?
No. We've been talking about kind of the difference between catastrophic damage and then there's, good practices.
Yeah.
I personally have a limit of mine, and that is I want to see my oil on my plane reach 100 degrees before I am willing to do my run up. It's my personal limit. I think it errs on the safe side by a decent margin, but it matters because
Yeah.
now you're talking about other things. Now we're not talking about like expanding and scuffing pistons. We've covered that. Now you're talking about things like is how's your fuel how's your sorry how's your oil pressure system running? And I've seen some things recently where people were starting up their planes even when it's fairly warm out and just buzzing to the takeoff and like there's no time for the oil to warm up. And you watch
Yeah.
the oil pressure and the oil pressure spikes before because it hasn't warmed up.
And so, and this is a more operational thing, I know, but I would want your input on this as well as a prolonged approach at low power setting and not even a turbocharged engine, just a regular normally aspirated engine. When you're that cold outside, doing a prolonged approach with the power back and are you cooling it? Are you getting it too cool?
That's sort of like the shock cooling concept. Like, are we
Yeah.
really doing much? And quite honestly, I haven't seen much evidence. I've
Okay.
talked to the engine manufacturers. We've looked at things of what causes like cracks in cylinder heads or things like that. And when I say cracks in cylinder heads, I mean like, really small ones that they find during annual. And I have yet to see anything conclusive. I
Interesting.
think unless you're doing something funky like flying a 421 with a geared engine that you have to worry about when you come back on the power. If you're just flying like all the planes we all fly, just fly the plane because the engine, the oil's operating, all your systems are going. Just have fun and just keep flying.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Now, Brian, I want to make sure we get to, I don't, this isn't all about this stuff, but let's talk a little bit about the flying aspect, and then I got all my list of fun, but I want to talk about flying safety when it
Sure.
comes to it. So tell me some of the things that are on your kind of list about winter flying safety.
Well, as far as, flying in the cold, having what you need on your person, obviously, to take care of yourself first. If you don't take care of yourself with, like I said, hat, gloves, scarf, whatever, in case you have, like what you said, carbon monoxide poisoning is a huge problem because now we're using our heaters, we're relying on our heaters. I think I'd like to hear some more on how to pre-flight, especially if you got one of those heaters in the back that actually burns your fuel or kerosene or something to heat the airplane, rather than that. Or the other risk is, you've got your heater system with blowing the intake air across your manifold, your exhaust manifold, or something to get the heat off of that. Then a little leak there gives you some carbon monoxide poisoning. So anytime using a heater is a risk, I think. Making sure that you have a good system that's safe is important, but then of course having the mitigation factor for that. How am I going to catch it if I get carbon monoxide in the airplane? And I think there are many wonderful methods nowadays. I mean, the Delta Zulu headsets that I have now
That's
that
what I was
talk
going to
to,
say.
I mean, oh my gosh, these are just fantastic. And we've heard stories of how many saves they've had. It's been fantastic. So being aware of that, I don't like the little round card that you can stick to your panel that supposedly changes colors that, you may be colorblind when you're
They shouldn't even sell those anymore. That is, considering the safety issue that we're talking about, considering what the stakes are, it's absurd for someone to have one of those, in my
I
opinion.
agree. And a lot of, if you have the fancy avionics nowadays, they even have a lot of those have it built in with oral alarms. I think the oral alarm is very important. I would not want to rely on myself to have to look at a dot to see what color it is or to see an indicator. I want to hear an oral alarm if that's it's coming into the airplane.
Oh, you mentioned Lightspeed Delta Zulu. I want to say something about that because
Sure.
there's three stages, right? There's the little stupid thing we all hate now that you have to proactively look at. But then a lot of people have like carbon monoxide detectors that either they have bought at Home Depot or that they've got online that are little ones that they say are like okay for it, or even in some cases some built-in things. And I will say the third level is something like Lightspeed Delta Zulu. And the reason is this: I have experienced actual cases of carbon monoxide intrusion and alerts with both the system and with the Delta Zulu. Last year, when we were testing the getting doing a pre-flight for our annual inspection, which happens this time of year every year, we go, we do a flight, we write down all our numbers, we figure everything out. And one of the things, of course, is, hey, this is one of the first times it's really kind of cold. We open up the heat. And all of a sudden, the Delta Zulu, through its canary carbon monoxide detection system, starts yelling in my ear,
Really?
"Hi, carbon monoxide. Check carbon monoxide." I knew
Wow.
exactly what was going on. We got down, we found a muffler problem. It
That's
was
amazing.
total crack in our muffler. Now, counter that with a system that I'd had in the past that was still digital. And what happened in that case, beep, 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 beep. Beep, beep. And I'm telling you, Jake and I looked at each other like, what is it? What's going on? What's the beep? What's the alert? We didn't know, right? Because you've got stall warnings, you've got gear up warnings, you've got other things that could be going off.
Yeah, use your words.
Beep. Well, I mean, talk to me about it. You're a professional pilot. Tell me about the difference and why, because I'm telling you from my perspective, there's no, we. In one case, we were alerted to it and it caused confusion in the cockpit and distraction as we tried to figure it out. And in another case, boom, we knew exactly what it was thanks to Lightspeed. And I mean, how could you not do this in this day and age if you're shopping for a headset? For goodness sake, it's a no-brainer.
And I just saw someone posted, I usually open the air vent slightly when using the heater, and I do the same thing. And the reason I do that is I did buy one of those, little rectangular ones from Home Depot that takes a 9-volt battery, and I just set it on the floor, down by my feet. I just leave it there. It's got a little Velcro, so it just sits right there. And it was an eye-opener to me at Corps of Educational. Like, I was flying the airplane with everything closed, not even the heat on, and I noticed the levels on there. It was just reading just some infinitely small number. I forgot what it was. But then I opened the heater and I saw it went up just a tiny bit. But then I opened my window, the air vent on the airplane, and saw how quickly the number dropped. It was just amazing. That obviously just beeps. And you had mentioned something else that's very important for, flying on the airlines. You're offered the highest degree of safety. So we have to have better warning systems, better this, more redundancy that. Well, most of the warning systems talk to us and they use words to tell us what's wrong. It's not just a stall warning horn. We actually hear the word stall, stall, or a lot of the things that go wrong and the systems that go wrong, it'll talk to us. Pull up, too low, gear, all those things. So it's very important and a much better safety aspect if it's talking to you, like the Delta Zulus do, and tell you exactly what it is. There's no thinking, there's no confusion, just like you said. Another backup to that that I use, I have a Sentry Plus that I bought for to use with ForeFlight, and it also has a carbon monoxide, and it will talk Bluetooth to my headset through ForeFlight as well for carbon monoxide detection.
I
Another
just
aspect of winter
like
flying is getting colds and flus, and that's what I'm getting over, and you could probably hear that right now. So it goes without saying that do your I'm safe checklist, and with the cough syrup that I'm on and the way I'm feeling, I pull the plug on it. No flying right now.
and I'm glad you're getting better.
Thank
I
you.
want to address something that you brought up there because I'm gonna sort of contradict it a little bit just because from a maintenance perspective. The idea, I want to be clear that venting your cabin is good in terms of a remediation. If you encounter carbon monoxide, doing something to vent it will make a huge difference. You need to be trained in it, just like you were going to react to anything else. Doing it on a regular basis as a method where I know some people are like, well, when I use my heat, I crack the window a little bit or crack the vent a little bit. I'm not a fan of that, and I'll tell you why. Because your aircraft should not be allowing carbon monoxide into the cockpit. You shouldn't have any measurable. Now, there are certain cases, right? Like you're in the ground, you're taxiing, windows open, vents open, certain things, certain regimes of flight, you get a certain little bit amount. That's different. But I want to find the problem and fix the problem.
Yeah, you're masking it,
I
I
don't want to
guess.
mask a problem to the point that it then, let's say it's an area that's not sealed, that's letting it in. Or let's say you have this constant amount that you can totally remediate by cracking vent, and it turns out that's coming from the exhaust. Well, once that opens up, you've lost that. That's your safety net, right? That cracking, well, that was it. That was your safety net. You, when it was low, and you had the windows closed and your alarm went off. Now you had this safety you could turn on, you could lower it, you could land, you could fix it. Now you've lost that. That's why I'm concerned about that.
That makes sense. That's good advice. I'll definitely take heed with that. When I opened mine also, it was more of a demonstration to show just what fresh air will do, but it was indicating a carbon monoxide coming in the airplane at some point, obviously, because it was going down when I opened the window. So you're saying under no circumstance should there be any measurement of carbon monoxide in the aircraft?
Well, so again, I want to say certain regimes of flight have certain different
Yeah, that
things,
makes sense.
right? Because it's all about if your natural exhaust, let me be really clear, exhaust is meant to come out your tailpipe, right? And that has high levels of carbon monoxide in it. In normal flight, in normal operations, it is designed so that that will not go into your air vents, so that will not go in through any other seal. But you sit on the ground, especially with a tail drag, your window's open, breeze is blowing just a certain way. There's a lot of things that can happen that can let it in a normal situation, and you get some low amount of that. And if you go check it, if that's your indication to check it, and you know it was just because of the position I was in and the window was open or whatever, That's fine. I'm not saying zero tolerance for that. But cruise? Oh yeah. Zero tolerance. Regular approach, regular takeoff, zero tolerance.
Well, that makes sense. And I've got on the ground when I see these things in my airplane, it makes sense also because, like you said, even if I don't have my window open, I have holes in the bottom of my airplane for the flight control cables to go in and out of. I have air vents for, fluids to drain out of. There's all kinds of holes. I can see through, it's a fabric airplane. I can look through certain holes on the floor and I can see the ground. So it's obviously not like your airplane where it's nice and airtight. A lot bigger difference when you're not moving at all. So,
Hey, retracts do the same thing. It retracts. You've got whenever you have a retract, you've got rods and other things that are coming in through the wheel wells into the cabin, and they have little seals on them and little things that get zip tied, and inevitably they become like leaky, and some of them are missing or whatever, and so you're still gonna see something. Just know what it is, figure it out. If you can solve it, you can solve it. If it's a really low amount, you know where it's coming from, and you've decided you're gonna fix it some other time. At least you know. What we're really worried about is major exhaust intrusions into the cockpit.
Yeah, it'll kill you. If you're not aware of it, it can definitely kill you. And that story of the guy that crashed his Mooney while he was passed out and lived, that was, I forget his name, but that's an amazing story as well. I think we've beat that up. You mentioned retractable aircraft. You fly a retractable aircraft. When you fly, do you ever have snow on your runway or a little bit of,
Oh,
snow or
yeah. Well, hey,
slush?
back in the days when it used to get colder than it does now, we used to have an ice runway we fly to up here
Oh,
that should
really?
open up on Lake Winnipesaukee. At
Oh,
it's
wow.
still on the chart. We just never know if it's going to open.
Would you land on it with wheels?
Oh yeah.
Oh my gosh, that would scare the crowd,
Oh,
something
it's
out
fantastic. Oh
of
my God, is it wonderful? Yes, you have to realize that there are no brakes.
Yeah, that would be, well, like a seaplane has no brakes either, but there's more drag than ice. But that's something I'll have to come up and do with you sometime. That sounds pretty cool.
That comes back. We will definitely do that. I want to talk about pre-flight. I want you to talk about pre-flighting when it comes to, like, you get out there, you got frost, you got snow on the aircraft, the wings. What do you do?
Yeah, so don't leave with anything on the airplane like that. You've got to give it off. You can't just take a hose and rinse. I'm kidding. if it's freezing out, obviously you don't want to rinse it off. I've seen all kinds of great ways of people trying to get it, like a heated hot water balloon or something where they're kind of wiping it off. But definitely do not take off even the slightest amount of frost, like the thickness of like a sheet of sandpaper on top of your wing will kill about 30% of your lift.
How about all these guys that say just polish it? As long as it's as long as you made it feel a little smooth, you're good.
No, not good enough because more can adhere to it. It could still, whatever caused it to appear can reappear. I don't like that idea. You need to have your flight controls and your lifting surface clear of ice. I mean, you cannot have any ice on it whatsoever. There's a little bit of an exception on some airplanes where you'll get a little bit of frost, like cold soaked fuel touching the skin on the undersurface. But look at the limitations of the aircraft. It should be okay for that. If not, you got to get it off. You got to get it in a hangar. blow hot air on it. There's all kinds of ways to do it. Don't scrape it. Don't scrape frost off an airplane. You can scratch the skin or actually arguably put in more friction, permanent friction on the surface, which you just don't want to do either. I had mentioned looking really closely, like if the airplane taxied in, you want to look in those wheel wells. It might have thrown some ice or slush or snow up in the wheel wells that is still there. That could affect the retraction of that gear. If you're
With
taxiing
brakes,
through, say it again.
I've seen it cause trouble with brakes.
And brakes, yeah. So what I recommend is leaving the gear down a little bit longer after takeoff. Build up a lot of speed, let it blow. We even do that in the airliner. If we taxi through slush, we'll delay gear retraction for 30 seconds to a minute and let it all blow off before retracting the landing gear.
That's really smart.
also, making sure that the aircraft is in a de-iced configuration for the takeoff configuration, not just the pre-flight configuration. So you want to make sure that everything moves. You want to pre-flight every flight control through its full range of motion, the flaps. If you take off with flaps, you want to make sure that in the takeoff flap position, it's free of ice and snow and that nothing's going to get on there to inhibit you retracting it. Some airplanes have limitations where if you landed in the slush or snow or taxied in it afterwards or built up a little bit of ice in flight, you want to maybe leave the flaps down until you have a chance to inspect everything afterwards. Don't just put them up right away. You could actually cause some damage. Maybe you've
Yeah.
seen that. I don't know.
Well, I mean, one of the th other things, just before I forget, because you talked about, airline operations and gear raising and stuff like that. I don't know what your thoughts are on the matter, but I like the idea of, in a retract, of tapping your brakes before you put your gear away, especially in that case of slush and wetness and all this other stuff. And the logic in my brain on this is, you want to know this system works for landing. You want to expand onto those pads where there's nothing in between while it's all water, while it's whatever. Make sure that you can do that so that when you land, they're going to pull back away, but so that when you land, you can do that. So you don't have a contamination that's there that you don't know about. And the first time you're going to experience that there's something preventing that is on landing.
Yeah, that's a fair point. A lot of airplanes actually, like the airliners, will actually have an application of brakes during the gear retraction to do something similar, but also to stop the wheel from spinning. I think it's a good technique. I use it even regularly. A lot of times, that's when you notice a wheel out of balance after takeoff and hit the brakes. Unfortunately, sometimes it's a nose wheel and you can't do anything about that. But hitting the brakes will stop that kind of vibration from an out of balance situation, which could actually be ice on your wheel somewhere.
Well,
But
you know what causes it the most, actually? It's interesting, and it all goes with winter. It all goes with temperature, right? Temperature's hard on rubber as well. Makes the rubber compound much harder. Aircraft are sitting in the same position for much longer. So what we often think of being a shimmy or an imbalance in a wheel, it's
Square
usually a
tire.
flat spot. It's usually that the aircraft's been sitting with a flat spot for a while. You get out there and you're like, what happened? Right? And it's got this flat spot on the tire going blah, 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 blah. And you think there's something else going on. The tire's yelling at you and going, dude, it's the first time I've rolled in a month.
I used to teach in St. Louis where we actually did have winters, and I lived up there for 23 years, and we noticed that quite a bit taxiing out. And sometimes just a high speed run down the runway just to make sure everything's cool, kind of work up the rubber and get it a little more pliable for the takeoff, and just to test things and make sure everything's working all right. But another thing is that you want, one of the advantages of winter is you really do enjoy some fantastic performance, which can be good and bad. Your airplane's going to accelerate wonderfully. If it accelerates normally, it might be something going on where, okay, it shouldn't be accelerating normally. It should be accelerating much better. And you're not, it could mask another problem that's keeping you, there is some kind of loss of power that you may not recognize. So just be aware that it should go a little better. Interesting story that we had on the 727, and I'm dating myself here, but it's kind of interesting. We would always try to take off with reduced power whenever we could to try to, be better on the engines. So we would calculate a fictitious temperature that we would say, okay, today we're going to pretend it's 95 degrees and set the power for that. And it's a lower power setting that we've calculated will work on this runway because that's the max temperature we could take off on this runway. Well, something interesting on the throttles is that, and this could happen in GA airplanes also, is that there are, could be a takeoff warning horn that when you get up to a certain power setting, a power thrust lever or throttle position, we'll set off that warning horn to tell you that your flaps aren't set, trim's not set, something's out of configuration. Well, when it was, I was flying out of Oslo, Norway in a 727, and it was minus something outside centigrade, at Fahrenheit, actually. It was really, really cold. Too cold. In fact, the airplane had a limitation that you could not do reduced thrust below a certain temperature. And it had nothing to do with performance, but it had everything to do with your throttle position wouldn't be high enough to set off the alarm that would tell you your flaps aren't down. So that's also something interesting if you fly something that has goes to take off power, something with a fixed wastegate or something like that, where you may not get the power up to trigger a switch, or you may get it up not high enough to turn the gear warning horn off while you're taking off. So little
Interesting.
things like that to be aware of that when it's so cold that you get that kind of performance.
I do want to say a few more things having to do with ice and snow removal. And I really caution people against kind of manually doing this other than maybe using your arm just to sweep off snow or something that's loose. I think, it's interesting when things get really cold out, we get a mindset that's survivalist, right? We don't care. We're just trying to survive and chip away and do whatever. And we damage things. As you mentioned, we can you can damage the paint if you I'll tell you right now, you do it on anything plastic, you do it on the windshield, you do it on the windows, you anything like that, you are going to regret it because those warm days show up and all of a sudden we have a different attitude, right? And now everybody's like, oh, what's the best polish I can get for my plane and ceramic coat? And if you look real close, you can see swirls in the paint. I'm going to polish this other stuff out to get the swirls out. And I'm looking at the same person that I saw with a credit card going, like, and I'm like,
Oh,
it's
no,
the same person?
yeah, exactly. It's not a good idea. But also, I did say something earlier that as I think about, I really don't like the idea of, and that's blowing hot air. You have to be cognizant of where that warm water is going to go,
Oh, yeah.
where it's going to refreeze.
No, you don't ever do that. You said a warm hanger is what I heard you
Warm
say.
hanger is what, yeah, but I also
That's
said
the
if you could
answer.
blow it off, and what I was talking about is blowing off dry snow if you can, but you certainly don't want to use hot air to melt something that could refreeze somewhere else on the airplane. And then I want to make that clear.
Yeah, refreezing is a big issue, and it's really, really important to make sure people understand that. If you are doing anything that is going to have the ability of refreezing, I can guarantee you that water is going to find its way into something much more dangerous than it did when it first came down. So it usually, when it first comes down, it's going to freeze on surfaces that are not as, it could, but it's not nearly as bad as melting it into something else. So the best thing, of course, is glycol. That's what the airlines use. FBOs will have it and they sell it, but it's expensive. You can use the same thing that like TKS systems use that can, they're fluid, but again, it's expensive to use that. The other option that you can do, it kind of as you go down the list is polypropylene antifreeze, which is used in like RVs. It's usually pink or something like that. That's generally safe. You want to be really careful and make sure it doesn't stain your paint. Make sure if you got a composite aircraft that again you're not going to do something that all of a sudden you're like, wait, nice spring day and you're like, great, now my plane is pink. But those things are a little safer because it's not itself going to freeze, so it's not going to collect somewhere and freeze.
So when I go to work, I just say, please de-ice me the full aircraft tail and fuselage with de-ice type one, and then anti-ice me with type four, wings and
Yes.
tail. That's what I do. And then I sit there drinking my coffee in a warm cockpit, watching all this magic happen. I have to make a PA to the passengers, of course, to let them know that they might smell of fumes for just a few minutes, but it's not toxic.
Yep. There you go. You
But
don't have to
yeah,
do it very
so.
much. I want to say the last thing you can use is alcohol. Just make
Yeah.
sure it's a very high concentrate. You don't want, because
What's a high
alcohol,
concentrate, like 90% or more?
yeah, I mean, you want something, and again, this stuff isn't cheap when you get it, and the higher concentration of
So
alcohol,
what proof are
because the
we
rest is
talking?
water,
So we're talking 180 proof at least.
yeah, exactly. Not that kind of alcohol. Isopropyl, please. Rubbing alcohol, things like that, again, can help you in those circumstances. You just do your best. Just don't make it be something that can accumulate, as you mentioned.
My go-to has typically been finding an FBO that'll let me put it in the hangar for a while. And that's been my go-to, like in St. Louis when I was flying there. We also had preheaters, Tannis preheaters on the aircraft there at the flight school. I mean, places where you're commonly going to get that kind of cold, like where you are, I would think the flight schools have something like that. I know my son went to UND and they could put their entire fleet of 100 and something, I think it was 117 airplanes in the hangars. In their big, they have three or
Wow.
four big hangars, and they can get them all in. And they do. They're in for pre-flight. They take them out. They get them all back in. It's just
Wow.
amazing how often they're not out on the ramp very long.
That makes sense. If you're up at UND, that's your best option.
Yeah, it's the best cold operations money can buy.
Yeah. You know what costs less than having a hangar that you can put that many aircraft in? Not living up there.
Got someone from Grand Forks, love the UND mention. You guys, I got more respect for you guys flying up there. I'm sure you can appreciate the performance of flying your airplanes up there, but I remember my son would call it No Fly November.
It's so cold that they can put, eight people into a 172 and take off with ease.
The IFR, now I don't know how many IFR people we have. I think we're generally talking VFR most of the time here, but for IFR, obviously there are much more considerations. That we need to talk about.
First of all, well, even before we go into IFR, we'll talk about night flying, right? We
Yeah.
have How much, I mean, I don't know how it is down by you, but here I'm pretty sure that it gets light at like, whatever it is in the morning, 6 in the morning. It gets dark at like 6:30 in the morning. Whatever it like whatever we're getting is not enough sunlight.
Yeah, I
And
think you're getting a
so
lot more darkness than we are, but it's not light here till 8 a.m. and then 7:30 a.m. maybe, and then by 6 p.m. it's dark again.
yep.
So
This is
yeah,
a
we have a
great
lot.
time to invest in your lighting, and I just did that.
Yeah, me too.
Oh,
I have so many flashlights that take different kinds of batteries or recharge, and it's just people make fun of me how many flashlights I have. But so
tell me
you.
what you fly with.
Oh, I have a Phoenix that it was a $100 flashlight, but I like to be able to buy batteries if I can. I also like to be able to recharge if I can. But I just got this new nifty one. It's an Olight, but it's also got you can do a red light for the cabin. So not screw up your thing, your lighting. It's also got a clip on it, so you can put it on a headset. You can put it, and aim it whichever way you want. It turns and it's got a magnet. You can doink it to something magnetic. I love this little thing, but I've got about 15 different lights. But you're talking about aircraft lighting as well, which I think is, first of all, your batteries die when you use the flashlight. Okay, that's when they die. Don't check it and say, oh, it works, and be good with that. Have a spare batteries, have a second flashlight, because that's the last thing. You may not be able to be changing batteries in flight. So have a second flashlight. Obviously, LED now, you just can't go wrong. I would not own an incandescent flashlight.
Yeah. Use and have a really good one for your pre-flight, right? I mean,
Very
something with a
good one.
wide beam. I think you should have
Yeah.
something that's a little more flood-like to take
Yes.
around for your pre-flight, as opposed to just something you would use in the cockpit
Yeah, don't be
so you can
afraid to
see
pay
it.
a little bit more for it. So the one that I mentioned, the Phoenix that I have is this one, and you turn it on and it's relatively dim. If I aim it back here at my E6B. But it's got all kinds of settings. I can go brighter, but wait, that's not all. I can go brighter. And it's got, when I'm looking at up at the tail section of an airplane or the engine and inlet and looking in all the nooks and crannies, I want something that's going to light it up. And this thing it's got you can put rechargeable batteries or the kind you purchase in it. Love this thing. It's $100 for this little thing, but worth every penny. And
For
same goes for
pre-flight.
aircraft lighting. I just upgraded. I think you did too. I put an LED landing light on. Oh my gosh.
Oh yeah. You know what I, well, actually, before I do, I just want to say what I do for pre-flighting is I have one of those, like, it's actually just a Home Depot one, those rechargeable, like, area flood ones. They're
Floodlight,
small. It's
yeah.
like maybe 5 by 7, and it and rechargeable, and like has this big wide area that lets me take everything in. If I want to step
Yeah.
back and see like, because you never know, right? Maybe someone backed into a wing.
Yeah, I love that. Why be tunnel visioned on your pre-flight too?
Yeah, I want to have broad.
Yeah.
If I look into, if I look looking in a wheel well, I want to see all of it lit up. So anything I can do on that. But you did
Yeah.
talk about, you are talking about aircraft lighting. So I just upgraded to Z Vision, which is an XC Vision HID lighting in the front. And I'm a huge fan of LED
You talking about exterior lighting on the airplane?
landing light. This is a
Landing light.
landing light. And so, huge fan of LED. I've all my LEDs are from WAT Wheelan Technologies. But in terms of landing, if you actually look, even though LED is the cutting edge of technology, and
Yeah.
HID is like one step, older, the light output is
Yeah.
greater. And so, of a ballast HID light, and so it's pretty impressive. And it lets me, we were just checking how far away we see the runway numbers at
Yeah.
night. And yeah, you basically see them from another airport. It's pretty cool.
All right. This is important. Hands-free is important too, I think.
I
You got to be able to do that. And that's this little light I bought too. It also does
thought you
that.
just do that when you're making tunnels in the snow.
Yeah, or if I'm
That's your
spelunking.
miner hat.
Yeah, exactly. No, you taught me everything there is to know about exterior illumination.
Anyway, if anyone else wants to check that out, go look XCZ Vision. Very, very cool stuff. Like I said, you just sit there on the ground, light up two things, take a look at them, and decide what kind of things you want to do. But to me, at night, can never have enough
Oh,
light.
I agree. Go for the best. Go for the most you can. I agree. And also at daytime, even for collision avoidance and making yourself more conspicuous, I like a lot of light. You look at two airplanes on final on a sunny day, Go out to the airport. You can see airliners, you can see their landing lights coming in from way far out before you can ever even see the airplane.
Oh, you know, and that, let me say, that's a good point in terms of like there's advantages. There's lights for different things. I happen to have recognition lights in my wingtips. And of course, if my gear is down, I have a taxi light too. Those recognition lights, they're called recognition lights, but really they're landing lights. Those are LED. What's nice about that is LEDs are great for pulsing. Like you want strobes, you want recognition, you want to wig-wag, you want to do. If that's what you want out
It
of your
doesn't
light,
hurt the light. It's not a
go
bulb. It's
LED. Yeah, HID doesn't do that. HID is an arc that's formed by carbon arc, and it warms up. It is like the old style stuff where it starts, it's one color, and then it gets brighter and brighter and brighter. That's for a light that's constantly on, but it throws an unfathomable amount of light out. So if it's constant, you want to land somewhere, that's your answer. If you want pulsing, if you want other kind of stuff, and you want low current draw, LED all the time, all day long.
I remember flying an airplane that had the xenon lights. That was xenon gas, and you turn them on, and they weren't bright right away. It took them a
Yeah,
while to get
like the
bright.
old sodium lights. I'm in my hangar. You wait half an hour and they get bright.
Oh yeah, like it's baseball stadiums. Now you see when someone gets a home run, they're like flashing all the lights. You're like, oh my gosh, I remember when it took 20 minutes to turn the lights back on.
Exactly. It's we've come a long way.
No,
Life's
that's
a
cool.
big
I'm eager
adventure.
to hear how you like those as you progress, and if you have, you should take some pictures, of if you
I'm
can.
already, I'm telling you, I'm already in love with the thing. It's crazy. And I get to compare it because it's right above the taxi light. And the taxi light is a real modern, real bright WAT light. So it is a good light,
That's what I have on my
but
airplane.
it doesn't hold a candle. It's just technology difference.
Well, very cool. Very cool.
So, hey, talk to me about icing. I want to hear about that because I will tell you, I am, as a pilot, I am scared to death of ice.
So I used to take my students up, I was teaching out in California, and we'd go out over the Central Valley when a cold front moved in, and the statute of limitations has passed on this. So all of you, don't even bother writing. I know what you're going to say. But we would go up in a Piper Warrior or an Archer, and the MEA was like, say, 2 or 3,000 feet, but there was a 4,000 foot cloud layer, and the freezing level might have been 5,000 feet. And so I would request to go up in it and show my students what it's like to pick up ice. Now, in a Piper, you've got those little air vents down by your ankle, little ankle vents you can turn on. If you're getting in the clouds, open those vents a little bit, because when they stop giving you air, guess what? Your leading edge is iced up, because that's where it gets the air from. So,
Oh, wow.
little know your systems. If your airplane can do something like that, you've got a built-in ice detector. But on a white airplane with a white wing, it's really hard to see ice. So you need to be another good case for a good flashlight if you're doing it at night. But generally speaking, you got visible moisture and you're below 0 degrees, just plan on having ice. There are some clouds that don't have as much or as large a water droplets. In many cases, if you're too cold, you're not going to get ice. So there are cases where you're not going to get ice, but you need to figure that if you're going to fly IMC and it's below zero, you're going to pick up ice. And that would be a hard no-go for me in a single engine airplane or something that's not certified for icing conditions. Now, that said, I violated my no-go before I had that strict no-go decision. I've gotten into it and I've gotten ice. The important thing is here, have an out, because it's not known icing if no one's been there, or if it's minus 10 and it's snowing, you're probably not going to get ice. It's probably just going to blow dry snow over your airplane, or you might pick up just a tiny little bit. But if you're between 0 and 5 degrees, that's where it's really dangerous, because you're not quite freezing. It's close to the freezing level, and you're going to get a lot more, way more susceptible to picking up ice. Also, getting toward the top. So if you have a choice, the middle of the cloud is not going to be as icy as the top. I would always notice the tops. I would call it the tops indicator. We start picking up ice. I'm like, oh, we're about to break out as we're climbing, because as you reach the tops, there's always a lot more moisture in the cloud near the tops. I can't explain why. I'm not a meteorologist. I'm just telling you that my experience is, as I climb through an icing level, when we start picking up heavier ice, we're about to break out of the clouds, because that's the tops. But have an out. If you are afraid of it, it's okay to go fly in and see what it's like. If you're on an airway, like I said, the airway MEA is below freezing and you can get down there, good. What I don't ever want to see anybody do is you've got an MEA at 9,000 feet, freezing levels at 8,000 feet. Then you've got no out. There are also the, you know, if you get a lot of freezing rain, it can build up like cold soaked water droplets can hit a cold soaked frozen airplane and build up ice really fast, clear ice, which is hard to see and builds fast. The Rime ice builds a little bit slower. It's easier to see, but it can do more damage to, you know, lift and drag because of the roughness of it. The idea is just to be aware wherever it's possible to have ice, have an out. That's the important thing. So have you gotten into yourself into a situation where you've gotten ice where you didn't think you would?
You know what? Honestly, only a tiny bit. And in those cases, got out of it quickly and just, I'm scared of ice. So I, as soon as I see it, I'm like, I got to get out of this.
It's a valid fear.
Even if it's a really small amount, I will say it's important for people to know, even known icing systems, even when you get an airplane, it says, you know, certified for known icing. That's not to linger. It's certified if you know there's a layer, you're going to go right through. To go through the layer.
Like, or certified to get you out of the icing, right?
Pretty much. It is not certified to stay.
So it brings up a question. What is known icing? You know, it used to be the FAA would say visible moisture and temperatures below zero centigrade is icing conditions. Is that known icing? Not necessarily, because if it's like up in UND and it's minus 20, minus 30 outside, you could go fly through the clouds all day long. I would be willing to bet you're not going to get any ice. Build up on the airplane. It's just too cold.
I think it's a good question. I mean, in most cases when we've, you know, what are these things, these terms and these concepts and these discussions matter usually when there's an enforcement action, right? Were you involved in something with known icing? And my experience during that is that definition gets thrown out of the window and the people start looking at, this was the forecast. This was this, this was that. Should your training have taught you that this is what known ice means? I mean, I don't know. That's what my gut says. That is not a legal opinion.
Well, I do have a legal opinion here. I can actually share with you that the FAA says there's three regulations you need to be aware of. One, 91.9A, it states no person may operate without complying with the limitations of the airplane. So if it's not certified for known icing and you get into icing, well, that's going to be a problem. 91.13 says no person may operate in a careless or reckless manner. So doing so, getting into it, knowing it could be there, and it being in an airplane that's not certified is careless and reckless. The third one is specifying that each pilot in command before beginning a flight must become familiar with all available information. Well, the problem is all available information, man. There's so much information available now. But that's one of the most important ones that for winter flying is knowing where is icing conditions. PIREPs are huge. Definitely look at PIREPs. That's actual known icing as someone reports actually having seen it. But it goes on to say that in this letter, and what I'm reading from is a letter of interpretation for Miss Alicia Bell. It's the Bell interpretation of January of 2009. And it says that definition, the FAA defines known icing as known or observed or detected ice accretion or actual ice observed visually on the aircraft by a flight crew or as identified by onboard sensors. So one of the important things to realize is that what's going to happen, like you're saying, is the litigation part of it or the enforcement aspect of it. And I'm trying to find that section. I had it. The FAA will use in determining. So as a result, a flight which results in the formation of ice on an aircraft is not the sole factor the FAA will use in determining whether enforcement action is warranted in any particular case. In determining whether enforcement action is warranted, the FAA will evaluate those actions taken by the pilot, including both pre-flight actions and those taken during the flight, to determine if the pilot's actions were in fact reasonable in light of those three regulations that I just read you.
And well, that's, I mean, you know, yeah,
that's the important part.
Consider that 91.13, careless and reckless.
Yeah,
that's been used with pilots who did not clear all of the frost off of their wings and subsequently had an incident.
Well, we've been told many times
91.13, they cited them for that, careless and reckless, because you didn't do that.
And that makes sense. And you got to think about that. Just so you know, when I flew the MD-80, I just got to share this because I know we're running out of time, but our ice detection indicator was actually a cotter pin on the windshield wiper. Ice will adhere, it will start accumulating first on a very narrow or small radius objects. And this is why we did that on the MD-80, is they would just put a big loop in the cotter pin that held the nut for the windshield wiper on. That's the first place we would see it. And sometimes I've seen some pretty serious ice built up on there.
Is that why you guys would lose wipers constantly in that aircraft? Is it
Why
that cotter
we
pin would come off?
No, the wipers, no, I hardly ever use it. The only time I've ever used wipers for landing rollout or taxiing, at a higher speed, it's all blowing off. But
Just put the cotter pin in a little bit. That's good enough.
yeah, the cotter pin is the important part for you don't have to operate the wipers to actually have that build up the ice on it. That was our indicator. It's pretty funny.
That's pretty wild. I love that. That is very, very cool.
But as a reminder that that's where it's going to indicate first. Is on the narrow, like the leading edge of your stabilizer, and your vertical and horizontal stabilizers will pick up ice before your wing will, because it's a tighter radius. So you may not even be aware of picking it up back there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that is some cool stuff. Well, Brian, we're coming to the end now of another Cockpit to Cal show. It feels like we just started tonight.
I know. Is it already? Oh my gosh, it's already time. Time fly. I know someone was asking, you will get Wings credit automatically just for being here with us tonight.
Why don't you show everybody your flashlights again and name them, because a bunch of people want to know what that is.
Yeah, this is the Phoenix PO35. This is why I love this one. And it's just got several different brightnesses. Another thing is when it's full bright, man, this thing is also a hand warmer. It gets really warm. What's really funny is we pull out our flashlights in the cockpit, and my co-pilot will pull out his big 3D cell mag light. I look at him and proudly tell him, size doesn't matter. Come on, let's shine it on. We shine it on the ground. I usually win with this.
Wow.
It's about $100. It's Phoenix spelled with an F and an X. Phoenix PO35. The other one I really like, and it can go on this headset, is a Olight. Spelled like that. It comes with this headband as well. But man, it's really cool because this part's a magnet, and it's the Olight. Excuse me.
So you just put that, you just hold it on your compass.
Yeah, just put it right next to the magnetic compass there in case you're not on the heading you want. It's the P Run 2, Perrin 2.
Wow. Cool
Yeah,
stuff.
love it.
Well, while we're talking lights, if anyone's interested, want to do a little shout out for the holiday lights that we've got for the show behind me here, which are these airplane holiday lights. I absolutely love them. There. You can get those at sporties.com.
Oh, those battery?
No, those are
Oh.
plug-in full holiday lights.
I want
They
to bring them
probably
in
ought to be
the.
sold out by now. There's
As I
lots
bring
of
them to
other
work
lights
with me, I
around
want to
me
bring
here.
some battery operated lights. Oh, that's cool. I have to look for those.
Yep, all with the holiday spirit. Well, Brian,
Great.
thank you for another wonderful Cockpit to Cal show. I look forward to this every single month.
Yeah, I do too. It's a great conversation you and I've always had is loved it. I love having everybody along to listen to it because I learn a lot talking to you, and you learn a lot talking to me just by between pilot and mechanic. I think it's an awesome dynamic having the two of us talk about stuff like this. Why not share it with everybody?
Absolutely. So I look forward to our next one as that comes up in January. This is it for Cockpit to Cal for December. We'll be back. Actually, Social Flight Live is back next Tuesday, December 17th. One of my favorite shows of the year, which is Major General Ratiff, the Director of Operations for North American Aerospace Defense Command, NORAD. We are going to get to talk about some real issues. He basically and NORAD's rules to me. I'll let you a little inside baseball here. Here's how NORAD operates when it comes to doing these PR media things. They basically say, as long as it's not classified material, if I ask the question, they'll answer the question, but they will not volunteer things, even if they're unclassified in certain areas. And so that means we can
Interesting.
get some pretty wild information.
So I'm going to shoot you some questions to ask then. I want to know about this
Yeah,
track
we
Santa
do that
business.
because let me tell you, there is some crazy stuff happening on our northern borders with our partners in Canada, And that is what NORAD's all about. And so you want to find out what happens as the ice recedes, as people are claiming territory, as we've got Russian intrusions, many, many things. This is not a quiet area.
I want you to ask him about those drones over New Jersey right now.
There's stuff going on.
Something's going on. I'd like to hear what they have to say about that.
There's a lot. So come to that show Tuesday, December 17th, 8 p.m. socialflightlive.com. You got to register at one word, socialflightlive.com. And then we're off for the holidays, back on Tuesday, January 7th at 8 p.m. with our year in review show. That's going to be really, really fantastic. Talk about aviation safety and more. And then we're back here, Cockpit to Cal, next month. So,
That'll be on the 14th, right? The second Tuesday.
Yes, sir.
And watch for the Shift Show starting January 23rd. I think that's the third Thursday in the month. I think it's the third Thursday every month we're going to do it. But anyway, January 23rd is the first one. Just keep an eye on the shiftshow.tv and you'll see the details.
I will be there, my friend. That is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, we'll be just to show off the logo and the new t-shirts that we got.
Look at that.
And anybody who's seen the stuff that I talk about might know what that means.
That's awesome.
Hey, Jeff, thank you so much, man. This has been a lot of fun as usual.
Absolutely. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate your time. And thank you to everyone who's taken time out of your evening to join us here on Cockpit to Cal. We'll see you next time. Wish you the best for the holidays. Stay safe. Keep flying. And I wish you all blue skies.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.